Hello and welcome to the Thinking LSAT podcast. In San Francisco, I'm Nathan Fox. With me in Washington, D.C. is Ben Olson. How are you, Ben?
Good. Excited to be here.
In today's maiden voyage of the LSAT podcast, we're going to introduce ourselves, chat about our goals for the podcast, and discuss one logic games concept that people really need to know. Ben, why don't you tell the listeners a little about yourself?
Sure. So I went to GW Law School, and after I went to law school, I started working for a law professor at GW who actually teaches attorneys how to write better. And while I was working for him, I realized that I really liked teaching and I really liked the LSAT. So I just thought, oh, well, maybe I should put these two together. And so I started teaching the LSAT in the DC area in 2007 and just kept doing it. And I love it. So.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've been teaching LSAT since 2007 as well here in San Francisco. Just my story is a lot like yours, I guess. I mean, I found out that I love teaching, and while I was in law school, actually, I was teaching LSAT and just sort of fell in love with the teaching part, fell in love with having my own little LSAT business, and just kind of haven't stopped. So what I really wanted to talk about in this first episode of the podcast is, first thing is I want to talk about our goals for the podcast. So maybe I have a list of things here, but why don't you start?
Sure. I guess, well, my main goal would be, maybe it's just one goal, but would sort of be to have fun just joking around about the LSAT. I mean, the LSAT's kind of a, it's a solid test. I think it's a test that should be respected in a way because it does a good job of consistently testing the same set of skills over and over and over again. But at the same time, it's kind of a test that takes itself, I think, a little too seriously.
Right.
And so there's a lot of things like when I'm teaching class, you're just like, wait, what did they just say? Why are they saying this? Who wrote this? And so it's something that's easy to laugh about. So I guess with this podcast, I think, hey, this is an opportunity to look at the LSAT, laugh about some of the things that it does that are kind of funny. But at the same time, while we're having fun, like there's a lot of little lessons in there that I think can help people do better. And, you know, every point here and there counts and helps. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the first things that I want to teach my students is just that it's a game and it can be fun if you let it be fun or if you try to foster that as you're doing the test. So, I totally agree with that. So we're going to talk LSAT strategy, obviously, over the course of these podcasts. We're going to give people as many tips as we can muster in the time allowed.
Yeah.
I envision having guests, having questions from listeners. And I really am glad that I met you, Ben, and I'm interested in meeting more people in the LSAT world. So I would envision having guests of both students and teachers so that we could meet more people. And I'm always interested in learning about how to be a better LSAT teacher. So I think I can probably get a lot from you to that end.
Yeah. Well, likewise. I feel like I can learn a lot. Yeah. My thoughts exactly.
So why don't we go right into our first substantive issue here, and you want to introduce it?
Sure. So I was just trying to figure this out, and the thing that we want to talk about is the substitution questions in the logic game section. If you haven't seen these questions before, this may seem a little out there, but if you have, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. It's the questions that they come at the end of a game, and they always ask you to substitute one of the rules in the game for another rule. In other words, they ask you to take one of the rules in the game out of the game and then find an answer choice that will replace that rule with a new rule, and the new rule will basically accomplish everything that the old rule accomplished?
So let me just read one. I'm not going to read the entire question. I'm just going to kind of quote from one of the questions that as it actually appeared on the LSAT. We listeners should know that we're going to shy away at all opportunities from violating our license that we have each have to reproduce LSAC copyrighted material, but it seems fair use to me. Not that I'm a lawyer, but I did go to law school, by the way. But I'm willing to read this one half of a question. So here it goes. The question that we're talking about sounds like this. It's always at the end of the game. So this was a question number 12 at the end of a game number 2. And the question sounds like, which one of the following, if substituted for the constraint that if J is assigned to one of the ambassadorships, then so is K, would have the same effect in determining the assignment of the ambassadors? So again, it's you're going to substitute out one of the old rules. You're going to substitute a new rule in for that old rule. And that's the correct answer, is the rule that does exactly what that old rule did. Now, I have some really strong opinions about this type of question.
Yeah.
You want to go first, or you want me to go first?
Well, no, you should go first, because your advice is easier to understand, I think, and easy to implement. So
here's what I say in class. If I was doing the LSAT tomorrow for $1 million, I would, if I ran across this as question number 12 in the logic game section, I would skip it. And I'm pretty good at the logic games. After teaching LSAT since 2007, I'm pretty good at the logic games. And I still would skip this question because I feel like it's at least twice as difficult and twice as time-consuming as the other questions in the game. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't do it, but I would skip it and come back to it and do it at the very end of the section.
Okay, so your advice is even more strong than I had thought. I thought your advice was to skip it, but I was assuming it was only if you weren't like finishing the games or what, but you're saying even you would skip it.
I think I would.
And okay.
It's the reason why is really just risk aversion. I know that I can get a lot / all of the points in game number 3 and in game number 4.
Yeah.
If I have enough time. And I just want to harvest the bulk of those points before I bother with this one question. What I tell my students is, you know, this question is only worth 1 point, just like every other question on the test. But
yeah.
It's in a way, it's not even worth 1 point, because a random guess should get you 1/5 of a point. No, you're not going to get 1/5 of a point, but in expected value, you're going to get it right 1 out of 5 times. So it's sort of like 1/5 of a point just for bubbling in a bubble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that said, if this is, again, the $1 million LSAT challenge, I'd rather press my advantage, which is the ability to kill game number 3 and game number 4.
Yeah.
I'll do that first and then come back to this one question. And this is about the only time that I would recommend doing that, is this question right here.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess I've looked at these questions a little differently in the past. Maybe I'll have to rethink. I didn't realize your position was so strong, but what I recommend is somewhat similar in the sense that I would say for this question type, if you're not finishing the games for sure, and even if you are finishing the games, but you're not getting, you know, if you're still getting more than 3 wrong or so, then I would say skip it. But then after that point, I guess I would start trying to do it. Now, if you're saying like, you're going to go take the test tomorrow and you're still getting 3 wrong on the games, yeah, it probably still makes sense to skip it. With the caveat that if it's in the first game, like I'm looking at test 57 right here, which is the June 2009 LSAT.
Okay.
That substitution question is in the first game, which usually tends to be easier. And it's question five. And it's really actually a pretty simple substitution question.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah. Once in a while, that substitution question turns out to be really easy, or where the correct answer is sort of a transparent replacement of the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just for my, I guess the reason why I advocate so strongly for skipping is because for every time it's that easy, there are times when it's really hard.
Yeah. No, and I agree. It's definitely harder more often than it's easier.
Yeah.
I just think that, like, especially if I came across it in the first game, and the first game had turned out to be easy, because sometimes the first game is hard, but that's very, very rare. And so if it is an easy game, and since this question is coming at the end of the game, and I felt like, oh, yeah, this was easy, I would do it then. And maybe, so I would do it. So I haven't really thought about skipping it myself, but mainly because, you know, I'm thinking if you're that close to getting only one or two wrong, hopefully zero wrong, I feel like there is an advantage to doing it right when you finish the game, because the rules are fresh in your memory and so forth. And if it's an earlier game, it's more likely to be an easier one. But like you said, so the example you gave earlier was question 12. So that's already in game two. That game, which I know which one you're talking about, it's like in the 60s, right? It's like test 60...
This was October 2011. Yeah, I don't know the prep test number, but...
But yeah, so that game is kind of a hard game, too. And so as you're going through it, if you're like, oh, this is not, you know, your typical easier game for the second game, and you come across one of those, definitely probably going to want to skip it.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for you. Oh, well, first I wanted to point out, I really think that that's a good point that you make about if it's the first game, then you might give a little more attention to it, just because game one does tend to be very easy.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out, and I'm sure you are aware of this, that on the December 2013 test, that's the most recently released test.
Yeah.
This question actually appeared twice.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
okay.
And one of them was easy and one of them was hard. So it was like the one at the end of game one was really easy, and then the one at the end of game three was much harder. So that might give even more weight to your strategy of, well, if it's in game one, maybe I would recommend that people do it. But, you know, the advice that you were giving was based on people who are going to miss, you know, zero, one, two, or three or something like that on the section. But what about the vast majority of students who are really only, you know, how about the people who are trying to crack 10 points on the game section?
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, you should definitely skip it, because not only is it a tough question, it's a long question. And those things usually go hand in hand, but not always. Sometimes you have questions that are easy, but, you know, they just take you a long time, but everyone can figure them out. For these, I feel like when they are harder, even if people have a lot of time, sometimes they're still just like, yeah, I don't know how to solve it. And so it's going to be a question that consumes a lot of time. And as long as it takes as long as it would to do two or more questions, it's not worth it if you're not finishing.
Yeah, okay. So then I guess for most people, you would probably say, don't bother.
Don't bother, yeah.
Okay. So the advice then is, if you are scoring, I think we can probably agree now, if you're scoring pretty high on the games.
Yeah.
Like if you feel like you know what you're doing almost, then it's a chance to maybe do it, especially if it's in game one.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
our
advice?
Yeah.
I think I agree with that. I think that's fine. You know, I started off with my $1 million LSAT challenge thing, and the truth is, I don't know exactly. I've never done the LSAT for $1 million, so I'm not sure what my strategy would actually be in the moment. If I was feeling pretty confident about my understanding of the game, I very well might just, you know, especially do something like skim the answer choices and just see if one of them jumps out at me.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, the tragic mistake, and this is what I think most people do when they run across this question, is they spend just way too much time evaluating each one of those answer choices. And if they can't quickly sort through the five answer choices, which I think a lot of people can't do, that ends up being a big trap for people who don't know what they're doing, especially inexperienced test takers.
Yeah, and if you're not finishing, then that just means you want to do whatever questions you can do as quickly as possible, right? Because that's just more points. So I agree with you on
Absolutely.
That. Now, one thing, so you started out talking about like, oh, well, if you're going to take the test tomorrow, but a lot of times people are like practicing, right? And I think that's going to be a little bit different because you may not be finishing the games. Well, hopefully you're finishing the games. Maybe you're still getting like two or three wrong or maybe four wrong. And so it might not be the best time to start doing those questions. But at the same time, I think since you're practicing for the LSAT, like it might make sense to try to start doing those so that when you close the gap with the other questions, this question type is not totally new to you.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that somebody who's getting close to finishing is going to have, they're going to have to do this question. I mean, especially once they actually do get to the point where they're finishing the section, then absolutely, you know, they would do it. And in class, it's not like I say, oh, I'm not doing this one.
Yeah.
We're moving on. I mean, I definitely explain it and reason my way through it, but I find really frequently it's always like a comic moment in class because I start reasoning my way through it, and it's like it just becomes apparent immediately that you know, sometimes, like that question five in June 2009 that you're talking about, there's sometimes where I'll just say, well, B's the answer because whatever the answer is. That's the answer because I know what the answer is. But a lot of times, if I end up having to sort through the answer choices and really figure out what they mean, you know, that's, I guess, as an LSAT principal, I'm going to think about this for a second, but yeah, I mean, on the logical reasoning, I don't spend very much time trying to figure out answer choices that I don't understand.
Yeah.
I feel like I know what I'm looking for, and there's a lot of times where I'll read a logical reasoning answer choice where it just isn't making sense to me, and I just decide that if it doesn't make sense, that's because it doesn't make sense. So
yeah.
I'm not going to waste time figuring it out.
Well, I think this actually does raise like an interesting question, and that is when you do start doing these questions, what should your strategy be as you go through the answers?
I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah, so, well, a couple things. One is in talking about like what you're saying here in terms of like answer choices that don't make sense to you.
Yeah.
When I'm going through these on the test, you're obviously trying to move as quickly as possible, and I am as well. And so, like, if I hit an answer choice A, for example, and I read it and I'm stumped, I'm just like, okay, I don't necessarily see why this would be a good replacement for that rule. I'm inclined to move on, but I don't cross it out because I'm not saying, oh yeah, this is, I don't understand it, so it's wrong. I'm just saying I don't understand it, so I'm going to hope that I find the answer and then I never have to worry about A again.
Right.
But I'm going to leave it open. I'm not going to make the mistake of going too far and crossing it out because I think people want to, right? They want to cross stuff out because they want to say that's definitely wrong. And I guess I just have to keep it on the table. Because the other thing that might happen is you go through the rest, you might see, oh, these definitely don't work. And then you go back to A, and again, I still don't understand it, but who cares? I've just proven that the other four are wrong, so then this has to be right.
Okay.
And I think that can kind of save some time. Now, in terms of actually deciding whether an answer choice is right or wrong, I mean, thankfully, these have always been last, and I suspect they'll continue to be. But if they're not, I tend to do the... Regardless, either way, I tend to do the if questions first.
Oh, interesting.
And
okay.
And part of the reason I do that is because usually you have to create, or at least I create a mini diagram for that question.
Yes.
And so then basically I have a bunch of valid scenarios that I know work.
Okay.
And I cross out any that don't work so they don't ever look back at them. But as I'm going through the substitution questions, what I'll do is, in my mind, the correct answer has to be perfect. It has to be a perfect replacement. So that means the wrong answers are either too strong. In other words, they impose a restriction on the game that wasn't there before,
yeah,
or they're too weak, they, you know, allow things to happen that couldn't happen before. And so as I'm going through the answer choices, either one of those problems will knock it out. So like if answer choice B says T will be third or fourth, and I have a valid diagram where T is fifth, then I say, well, okay, answer choice B is imposing a restriction that's too strong. It's preventing things from happening that could have happened before because I've seen T in fifth, yet answer choice B is saying it can only be in third or fourth.
Okay.
So then I would cross it out. So basically, as I'm going through the answer choices, I'm kind of thinking about this strong or weak, and I'm looking at previous valid diagrams.
Okay. I think that's the exact same strategy that I would use. I like hearing your too strong and too weak language. I think that's really helpful. I might have to steal that in my classes.
I've been
saying that the correct answer does no more and no less than the old rule. So mm-hmm. same thing. If it would prohibit T from being fifth where T was previously able to be fifth, then mm-hmm. I would say that does more than the old rule, and so that can't be the answer.
Yeah.
And then I guess the flip side is if the old rules did not permit T to be fifth, mm-hmm. but the new rule would permit T to be fifth,
yeah,
then that does less than the old rule, and so it could be eliminated as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I still think people should probably skip it.
Yes, which I agree most of the time.
Okay.
Definitely.
Cool. You know, we didn't set off to talk about this, but I would love to hear your rationale for doing the if questions first. I know that people differ on this. On the logic games, I do not do this. I do the questions in order. But
okay.
I am interested in why doing the if questions first makes sense. And I'd also like to know if you would recommend that all students do that or just some.
So, yeah, I recommend it to everyone. And this is actually the order that I approach the games. I go through the setup. I diagram it. I think in theory it would be good to read the rules again to make sure that my diagram is correct, although I don't always do that, especially if it's an easier game. I'll just feel confident in my drawing and move on.
Okay.
But then once I hit the first question, if the first question is what I call a traditional first question,
right,
you know, the one where they ask for a complete and accurate list, five possible scenarios, if it's that kind of question, then I will do that right then and there because it's a perfect way to test whether I got the rules right or not.
That's the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, that's the question where when you test each one of the rules against each one of the answer choices, if you're not left with one and only one answer choice at the end of that, the game is teaching you that you don't get it.
Yeah, that's right. If you have trouble with this, you need to stop, go back, and figure out what you missed. It's often in the paragraph, I think, because
right,
you know, there's some rule up there that people just glossed over.
Yep.
But so I do that one first if it's the first question. Now, it's not very common, but every now and then they just give you some random first question.
Sure, right.
In which case, then I would divert to my second thought, which is after I do the traditional first question, then I go to all the questions that start with if. And the reason I do that is that, well, I guess there's two reasons. One, I think they tend to be a little bit easier. That's not always true. Obviously, there are if questions that are harder than the remaining questions,
yep,
but because they're adding an additional constraint, there's fewer possible scenarios, and so I feel like it's just easier for me to get my mind wrapped around the game when you're moving quickly. So it's easier. It's easier for me to get points on the board, so to speak. But the other reason I do it, and this is what we were just talking about, is that you start creating these valid diagrams, which then can be used to eliminate wrong answers or choose correct answers in the other questions. So for example, if a question says which one of the following cannot be true of the, you know, the order of the people or whatever, and this is like the second question in the game, but I've already done later questions in the game that started with if, you can often just say, oh, well, I'm going to eliminate this answer because I've actually seen this happen before. I know it can be true. And so you don't have to do any extra work because you already did that work for the if questions.
Yeah, I think it's great. I might not. I'll have to think about it. I think it could be really useful for somebody who doesn't have a great idea of the lay of the land to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're uncomfortable with the setup of the game for some reason, or if you feel like you haven't made a lot of inferences before the game starts,
mm-hmm.
then I think it that could be particularly useful. I might have to play around with that with a few students and see if they think it helps or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do it even, you know, even when I feel like I just kind of just, that's my mode of operation, right. I guess. And in terms of jumping around, so I end up jumping around, obviously, to do all the questions, but it doesn't really affect me in terms of, like, filling in my answer sheet or whatever, because I always just do all of them at once at the end of each game.
Okay, I think that's actually worth pointing out to students. We seems like we do that similarly. I also don't bubble in bubbles for every single question. Mm-hmm. I would bubble in. I used to bubble in at the end of every page. Now that the logic games are spread apart onto two pages rather than just an entire game on one page,
mm-hmm.
I might say, yeah, wait until the end of the game to do it.
Yeah.
Do the same thing on reading comprehension and logical reasoning?
Yep, same thing, except for at the end of the test, if after the five-minute warning, I might revert to one-to-one just in case, for whatever reason, the test ended before I finished, then I wouldn't have, you know, answers on the table.
I've been telling students now, and they're really happy with this. I actually have people at the five-minute warning, I have them just go ahead and bubble in a straight line of guesses for the remainder of the section.
Mm-hmm.
Because that only takes 15 seconds, and then allows them to take their eyes off the clock.
Yeah.
Because I find people just look at the clock way too much on the LSAT. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But particularly in the last 5 minutes, if they're worried about getting their free points that they get from random guessing, mm-hmm. they can really get distracted, and they end up, you know, going slowly and just missing a lot of questions because they're watching the clock so much.
Yeah.
So that's what I just say, hey, when the proctor says 5 minutes, go ahead and bubble in all the way down to question number 27 or whatever it is. And then you go back up and then, one for one from that point forward, answering the questions, erasing as necessary to fill in the new answers. The story that I always tell in class there is I had a girl who called me in tears after the test because she had been, quote unquote, darkening in her bubbles on her score sheet after time had been called.
Oh, no. Did
yeah.
she get caught on it?
So she, the proctor took away her test from her, and she got, like, a canceled score and, like, canceled under...
violation?
Yes.
She gets a V.
She got, like, the black mark on the permanent record, yeah. That, I think, argues pretty heavily in favor of just bubbling in the guesses at the five-minute mark to reduce any chance, you know. You can just put the pencil down as soon as they say time's up if you do it that way.
Yeah.
But otherwise, so page for page on the logical reasoning, or is that how you do it? And reading comprehension?
For logical reasoning, every two as well. So basically, I just do it every two pages.
Every two facing pages in the booklet.
Yep. And, I mean, so on your bubbling advice at the end, I think that's good. My only thought is that I don't think I would be inclined to do it because I'm planning to finish. And because there is this weird thing where I think after over time, you start to become like, I don't know if you feel this way as well, but like you start to feel, at least for me, when I get to the end of the test, let's say there's 30 seconds left and I don't know how, sometimes you can't tell that accurately because you're looking at an analog watch, but this sense that you have, like, you don't know what it is, but it seems like it's less than a minute. And you have one question left, that's where a lot of people, I think, will, especially when they first start studying, will just immediately, like, say, okay, test is over, bubble in my answer, and then just, like, kind of quit. But I've been surprised about how many times, like, I start reading the last question, thinking that the proctor is going to call time at any minute as I'm going through it. But how I keep going through the question, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm still reading. And then I read, like, answer choice A, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be over any second now. And then I'm like, and then I read B, and I'm like, oh, B seems right. So then I'll bubble in B, and then I'll start reading C, and then they'll call time. But it's just, I guess what surprises me is when you're reading quickly, how far you can actually go when it feels like you have no time.
Okay.
And I think that as you become more and more convinced of that, at the end, I mean, I guess it just, I would say, I would modify that and just, I would base it more on how confident you are in finishing, because I would feel like it would kind of take up time to like bubble it in and then erase it. But I think as a general strategy, it makes sense. I just,
again, I think that's like for most people, right? For me or you, if we were taking the test, we would be pretty confident that we were going to finish. So you probably don't need to bother bubbling in guesses at 5 minutes. I mean,
no, that's true. But I mean, a lot of, you know, a lot of people are, well, it just depends. I guess it would just depend on how close you are to finishing and so forth and what you felt.
Speaking of that, what's your advice on doing 35-minute sections of LSAT practice tests?
Well, I think it's really important. What's the alternative, I guess? What are you thinking in terms of like just doing like drilling specific types versus taking 35-minute sections? Or
yeah, I guess I just wanted to emphasize for listeners the, I think, huge importance of doing lots and lots of those 35-minute practice sections. If you do, then you will be able to know whether you're going to finish or not. And it's the only way to know whether you're going to be able to finish or not. So even as far as like formulating basic strategy, should I bubble in the guesses at 5 minutes or should I not bubble in the guesses at 5 minutes? Unless a student has done, you know, dozens of these 35-minute practice test sections, I don't think they have any idea what the proper strategy is.
Yeah. No, I definitely think it should be a big part of your study, although I would say it's probably something that's going to increase over time. Like at the beginning, you're going to be doing a lot more. You should definitely have to do it. Like a lot of people, I don't think they do any 35-minute sections at the beginning, which I think is a mistake, because even if you're studying like individual question types in some, you know, study book or in a class even, just whatever, you have to check in and take a full test, you know, let alone 35-minute sections, so that you can start implementing what you're practicing and see how fast you really have to go, so that when you go back and start practicing those things, even if you're not doing them in a 35-minute setup, you're not tricked into thinking, oh, I've got this and I can go this slowly or whatever. I think it gives people kind of a kick in the butt so they know what they really have to do.
Well, I mean, it's being realistic about what they're actually scoring and how do you know? I mean, you can you can read theory all you want. You can drill on question types all you want. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but that does not tell you at all what your LSAT score should be.
Yeah.
So I in my classes, I mean, first night of class, full practice test, right? 35-minute sections.
Yeah.
All the way through.
Yeah.
You're going to crash and burn. I don't care. I want to see what your score is.
Yeah.
So that we can establish a baseline, so that we can figure out what we need to work on.
Yeah.
So that we can move forward. And then how many timed tests do you do with your students?
So with the longest class, which is a 100-hour class, there is 8 tests, but then I would say students take home another 6 to 8, so they probably end up doing like 16 timed tests. But then I also give people a bunch of other tests, not to take as full-length tests, although they're certainly welcome to do so. I just don't know if a lot of people have the time within you know, the framework. But it's more like, okay, you're struggling with reading comp, go do a bunch of those reading comp passages, either as 35 minutes or, well, actually for reading comp, it's always 35-minute sections. I don't really see a good way of breaking reading comp down. Like, yeah. I know sometimes people want to go do science passages, and maybe that makes sense, but I don't feel like there's any really difference between the topics. But for, like, logical reasoning, I might say, here's 10 other tests. You can do them as full-length sections, or if you really just know you're struggling with the hardest ones, here's a list of the hardest questions, or here's a list of the flaw questions, Because some people, it's kind of rare as you get near the end of your studying, but sometimes people are struggling with just one type, which is nice, actually, because then you can go tackle it. But a lot of people, it's just random, right? They're just like, I'm doing logical reasoning, but I get random questions wrong. And I'm assuming it's usually just the hardest ones. And so going and targeting those in the time that they have between tests, I think makes the most sense.
Yeah. I just have my students do exclusively 35-minute timed sections and then review, right? So it's just hammer on test after test after test after test. I think that's stupid, but they do two tests per week and then review, you know, thoroughly review all of their mistakes.
Yeah. Now, in terms of review, like the games, do you have them do the games over again?
Frequently, yeah. I mean, especially after seeing my explanation in class, I do that with the private one-on-one students as well. You know, I'll be looking at their diagrams and giving them a couple little pointers about the diagram, and then I'll only get them like that one next step, and then I'll say, okay, now go do it. And absolutely, with my students in class, I will say, go back and redo this section. I think it's like, I don't know anything about neurology, but it's sort of like reinforcing the pathways of like how to make those connections.
Yeah.
You see somebody else make those connections, and then now maybe you get to make those same connections the next time you see it.
Well, one thing I think about too is that even if like someone ends up kind of memorizing a game, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Right,
like a lot of these games are so similar, you just say, oh, it's like that game. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense to deliberately go memorize games, but it can't hurt.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, that's like a musician or something who learned some song. It's not like they're going to say, like, oh, well, of course, I mean, I memorized that one. That's, you know, I don't really know how to play. I just know how to play that one song. Well, no, you're learning how to play the instrument. So, yeah, that is a good point. Like, even I could actually envision someone doing a game over and over and over and over to where it was just completely burned into their brain. Because there's going to be similar connections that they're going to make on other games.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up today's show?
No. I
want to know what you're doing for your break.
I'm only slightly jealous.
Slightly jealous of what?
What am I going to be doing for the break?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm jealous of the fact that you're in San Francisco. Because, you know, I grew up in Palo Alto, so...
Oh, okay. I didn't
know
that.
Now I'm out here. Yeah, this is kind of... The weather here is just... It's always really cold or really humid, so...
Is it muggy there already?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
This is... We had a, you know, 2-day spring, and then now we're into summer, so...
Yeah.
But what am I going to do over the break? Honestly, I'm probably going to work on LSAT materials, which doesn't sound like super fun, but for me, it's kind of fun. So,
awesome. Yeah. I'm going to do some of the same stuff, I think, put together like a more formalized curriculum, some checklists of things that I think students need to work on. But I am going on a little bit of a road trip. I'm going to, have you ever driven a car into Mexico?
No, I haven't. You're going down there, huh?
Yeah, I've obviously been to Mexico, but I've never driven a car across the border, and so I think I'm going to go on a little road trip with my fiance and never been to Tijuana, and go to Ensenada or something like that, stay for a couple nights.
Cool.
And check it out.
I didn't know you were getting married. Congrats.
Oh, yeah, down the road, but she's great.
Yeah, cool.
Okay, that was episode 1 of the LSAT podcast. We would love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback at podcast@thinkinglsat.com. We'll read the best emails on the podcast, and we promise that either Ben or I or both will respond to every single email we receive. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.